This is reflected in California's targets. So the legislator passed AB 32, and then the CPUC and others have been tasked with figuring out how to get there. So this is, starting in 2008, the official state policy or state goal is that all commercial buildings that are built will be, by 2030, will be net zero. And all residential by 2020, 6 years from now, in order to meet the goals of AB 32, all new buildings will be net zero. So the thing that is pretty shocking about this, it's not that by 2030 we'll know how to build net zero energy, it's that all buildings will be net zero energy. So clients like the Packard Foundation and others who are out there doing it now are definitely the vanguard, but their task, and I think our design and construction team's task, is really figuring out how this can be done and how it can be done at a scale that can really shape the industry moving forward. Just for, by way of definitions, just to make sure everyone here understands what we mean by net zero, this is a chart of the actual Packard Foundation energy use and production from basically 2013. The black line is energy use. You can see in the winter, we're using more energy than we're producing. But in the summer, we're producing more than we're using. And over the course of the year, these two lines, the area under these lines, should be equal so that we're producing as much energy as we use. And that's basically the math. It's pretty simple, which is one of the real positive parts and real things about the goal that actually make it very effective in a building project. It's not some abstract percentage better than some code. It's not LEED gold, LEED platinum, which is a good goal, but also not into, you don't really know what that means necessarily. This is something that's very tangible and people can really rally around. At EHDD, the architecture firm that I'm with here in San Francisco, we've been on this path for about a decade with some early work in 2004 through 2007, a small scale, starting with the visitor center in LA. And 2007, the first commercial net zero energy building in the world, the IDEAS project. 2007 is when we interviewed with the Packard Foundation and proposed that we thought we could do a 50,000 square foot net zero building. At that time, the only one that was done was 6,000 square feet. But we thought we could scale it up, and we're really happy to say that we've shown it that it can be scaled up. Following on the heels of Packard is the Exploratorium, just a short walk away from here. And that's over 200,000 square feet. We haven't been through a full year yet, but the aim and the design is to be net zero. So we are seeing the curb is way up. And this is a graphic from the New Buildings Institute looking at from 2010 to 2030 and getting towards that 100% of new construction net zero and looking at the kind of characterizing where we are in time. And I think it's accurate to say that we're here, we're in the early adopter mode. I think what Packard has done, they're not the innovators, they're not some of those early small demonstration projects, but they're definitely the early adopter, and we're seeing that curve moving up really fast, and Mike will share some, their company's been doing a number of these types of projects now, and I think they can attest to that. So I want to give a project overview just to give you a sense of what does this building look like, what's the building plan, how is it laid out before I dive deeper into the net zero strategies. So the project is in Los Altos, California, which is about 45 minutes south of here driving. And you can kind of see in the upper right aerial plan. It's a few blocks from the main downtown street, Main Street, so it's in a nice walkable community. And the site, this is the building here, the new building. Their former headquarters is here, and it's still in use by the foundation. It's built on a site that was a number of derelict buildings that really needed to be either taken down or fully remodeled. And we deconstructed that with DPR's leadership fully. And then it's a lot of landscape and of greening of the downtown in Los Altos. The basic floor plan concept is if you imagine a typical office building that a developer might build, let's say it's 80 feet wide with some daylighting on the edges, but pretty dark in the middle. We took the approach of taking that 80 feet and splitting it apart into one 40-foot wide wing here, one 40-foot wide wing here, with a courtyard in between, to allow really access to the outdoors, views, and daylighting for all the occupants. The basic layout, what you see, is that it reflects really how the foundation staff works. And what we learned early on is that about half their time is in very quiet, focused work, and half the time is in really active, collaborative meetings. So as you walk through the building, you move from these office neighborhoods that are quiet, kind of one, you know, single person working, to open meeting, office neighborhood, staff lounge, and then the courtyard, which is the largest kind of meeting space in the project. And the second floor follows a very similar pattern, you can see, with meeting rooms separating or linking, really, office neighborhoods. The building section, then, as I mentioned, those two 40-foot wings, and you can imagine within any point, you have views to the outdoors, there's access to operable windows, there's excellent daylighting due to that, the width and the way we designed the project that I'll get more into. The building also has a number of sun shading strategies, overhangs, trees, balconies, movable shades to make sure that we keep out the direct sun that we mostly don't want in the building while still allowing the daylight in that we do want. There's a lot of features that we're not going to talk about today that contributed to the LEED Platinum certification. Some of them, for example, 100% of rainwater captured. So all the rainwater from the roof is captured into tanks that are underground that we use for toilet flushing and irrigation. A lot of interesting stories around materials. Stormwater was a big feature, really capturing and cleaning all the stormwater that falls on the site. But that'll have to be for another day or after this talk. This is that courtyard that I mentioned, and it's really become, I think, even more than we imagined, a real heart of the project, and you see people out there all the time during nice weather, which is most of the time in Los Altos. And I just want to kind of second what Craig said about the, as he put it, the invisibility of the net zero to the staff. I think another way also to say is that there's an incredible quality of the space. There's nothing of sacrifice that you feel, and if you visit or for the staff, it's wide open to the outdoors. Takes advantage of the natural gifts of the climate. It has a very rich palette of materials, and this is the sidewalk elevation. It's a work of architecture that's not just about energy. It's about improving the kind of public life in Los Altos, setting a new standard for architecture there, and integrating things like these movable shades and overhangs and shades in a way that is not just a kind of technical fix, but a real kind of celebration. I'm going to go a little deeper now and really talk about how did we design it to get to net zero? What does that even really mean? And there's a lot of technical stuff here. I'm sure we have a mixed audience in terms of levels, so I'm going to try to speak in plain language. And really give you a feeling for projects that you may end up working on, what kind of process to take to get there, because it really isn't that complicated. So how we start out is we look at what is a typical building, where does energy go in a typical building? So this is a pie chart of a typical California office building, and about a third of the energy goes to electric lighting. About a third goes to ventilation, cooling, heating, you know, keeping the space comfortable. And a third goes to miscellaneous stuff, mostly plug loads, which is anything you plug into a wall socket, so all your office equipment, water coolers, anything like that is a big contributor. And we'll come back to that later as well. So when you look at that, at first you think, well, okay, we'll use really efficient lighting and efficient systems and all that, which is true, but really the first step is, especially as an architect, since we're, you know, the center, at least in our minds, is what can we do? You know, what can we do passively? What can the architecture do? And actually it can do quite a lot. So you can see here between daylighting and then what's called the envelope, which is the walls, the windows, the roofs, everything that kind of separates the inside from the outside. you can touch almost this entire pie dramatically and really impact it. So daylighting is really that keystone strategy, that fundamental strategy, partly because that's how architecture always is. I think Le Corbusier who said that architecture is the play of spaces and light, or that's paraphrasing, but that's what architecture is about, is that daylight and how it animates a space, but it's also what we use as the starting point for low energy design, partly to reduce electric lighting, but also to reduce the amount of heat that's generated by lights in a space. And in this project, it's the generator of the quality of the environment, as you could get a sense from these images, that it's just our goal was to create a space that was so well daylit that people didn't feel like they needed to turn the lights on for it to feel active and alive. So you can see here, this is the upper level office space, and there's high windows which bring really great daylight in, but we also added a skylight to balance the light in the space, and you can see here, and just create a space that had very little glare and felt comfortable without the lights being on. The surfaces, the color of the surfaces matters too, just how we selected finishes. We have our lighting designer, Janet Nolan, here. Raise your hand. There she is. So working with Janet on very efficient lighting, but especially lighting that can really turn off and harvest the energy savings that we have in a space that's so well daylit. A lot of times you'll be in offices, it's fully daylit, but the lights are on just because they're hard to control. So it's partly efficient lighting, but I think even more lighting that can be, it turns off when it should. And when you walk through this building, the lights are almost never on during the day. We have shades that are automated to protect against glare so that when direct sun's coming in or if the sky is too bright, people can still work comfortably at their desks. And then we have LED task lighting that's controlled with little sensors on each desk. So as you walk away from your desk, those lights turn off. When you come back, the task lights turn on. So it's really a lighting system that's working, I think, very well and working actually outperforming even what our energy model assumed. The next area is the envelope. This is an image that we took to kind of verify the performance of the project after it was built. And where you see yellow, that means heat's escaping the building. So there's a little bit here at the edge of the wall, and that's the roof up there. And then you see it around the door frames. But the wall, this is the wall, you see very little heat escaping. And in the glazing itself, the glass of the windows, there's very little heat escaping. And that's most of the building wall envelope. And that really was our focus. So this is what a typical wall framing being, you know, the studs that really comprise the structure of the wall. If we just framed it in a typical manner, this is what it would have looked like. But what you want to do is reduce, you know, increase the amount of area that you can insulate and reduce the amount of structure there. So what we ended up doing is we actually designed the wall, not just by rule of thumb, but how much wood do we really need in there and where should it be, and how do we actually create a wall that leaves more room for insulation and uses less wood. Instead of 3,700 board feet, we use 2,700, which saves money as well. So that was the wall area, and then the windows are about 40% of this building. So that was our next area to look at. A typical window today that's required basically by code is what's called a dual-paned window. So you have two layers of glass, and there's a space that's either filled with air or some kind of gas that serves as an insulation layer. When we started talking about the project, we knew about triple-pane or triple-element windows where you have three layers of glass and with two gaps, two air spaces or gas spaces between them. And they're used pretty often now in Germany and Canada in very cold climates. We started talking with suppliers and others about using it here, and people really said it doesn't make any sense. But we pushed a little further, and working with our engineers, Integral Group, looked at, and DPR Construction on the pricing, kind of looked at what would it mean to use them. And DPR said it would cost about $75,000 extra. What we found is by using this better insulated window, we could get rid of all a secondary heating system that we had around the perimeter, because when you have windows, people tend to feel less comfortable because there's a radiant heat loss through those windows. So we were actually able to eliminate a whole system of heating from the project and just heat a little bit through the air system in the mornings and get rid of this whole perimeter heating system. So it actually saved $75,000 in first costs upgrading the windows and eliminating mechanical systems. If you add on top of that the fact that the energy saved by not using that mechanical system saved a tremendous amount of photovoltaic panels that we would have had to put on the roof to reach our net zero goal, it's actually quite a win-win story on the cost. So these kind of passive approaches, you can call them, then allowed us to go from a conventional mechanical system that you'd see on the left, which is most office buildings, if you're down in Silicon Valley, have something like this, where they have an air handler with a compressor in it. They blow a lot of air in the space with either a lot of cooling. They blow a lot of cooling, and then they have to reheat it at the source if they want to heat the air. Because it's so much air, they recirculate that air because they can't just blow it all out and it'd be too energy intensive. Instead, our system has to do much less heating and cooling. So we can just provide the air that you need for good ventilation, allows us to bring in 100% outside air. So it's 100% air in, clean air coming through the building. We use a cooling tower that runs at night, which in this climate, it's cooler at night. We can generate chilled water, store it in a tank underground, and run that through the building during the day. So there's no compressor, which is the real energy-intensive thing, on the cooling tower. We could also go to an all-electric heat pump to create the hot water instead of a gas boiler. So it's an all-electric building. There's no gas burning at all in the building. So our zero energy accomplishment is a true one-to-one electrons to electrons. There's no offsetting of fossil fuels that we had to go through. The final step then is putting the photovoltaic panels on the roof. And we have about, I think it's a 292 kilowatt system, which is a pretty big system for a building. And it just covers this roof. Yes. So they were, staff was very hungry to move into the project when it opened. And this slide, I'm putting this here because the people really matter, as it says. And that's really especially true for the zero energy building. That's probably the biggest difference between this kind of goal and a conventional kind of sustainable or LEED building goal, because it's proven, as we'll show, in the course of operation, in the first year, in the second year, in the 10th year, it's an ongoing goal, and the design team and construction team can do so much to kind of give birth to the project and set it off, and then it's really up to the staff and the maintenance people to make it happen. So we really had to work that within our process to take that seriously and think about what that meant and work with the foundation to take ownership of the goal. Here's that pie again, and that is one way to look at the energy use, as I've illustrated, but another way is really looking at who's using energy and how do different people impact energy use. So the designers, that's what we kind of covered in the first half of this. We choose the systems and so forth. But the occupants choose what equipment to bring in, what plug loads they produce. They choose when they use the building, how much they really turn on the lights and all that kind of all those kind of choices. And then the operators, the building maintenance staff, the building engineers, they really make sure the building stays tuned up, they maintain it, they do something called commissioning, which is really just fine-tuning the systems over time. And all of these are just essential for the building to actually reach net zero. So on the plug loads, this is we did a study during design of the current building, and found that this is where all the energy is going. We monitored all their plugs for a few weeks. And then we did a report saying if you match your purchasing, like basically if you buy the same performing monitor and mini fridge and all this, all the stuff they had plugged in, but you buy the top 10% of Energy Star performers, you can reduce your energy use by 58%. And going into it, we thought there was a few behavioral modifications, like instead of everyone having a laser printer on their desk, we went to shared desktop printers, inkjets. But mostly it was just a purchasing thing, which was really an interesting lesson for us. And so they signed off on this. We built it into our energy model, and were able to reduce the size of our PV system and the cost to go along with it. The other big part is the people who run the building. So Juan has been a great building manager for the project. He was part of our team, and then after the building was completed, the design and engineering team actually were given the opportunity to stick around, help the foundation for the first year, monitor the building, troubleshoot where things were going off, and really train Juan and the staff on how to manage the building properly so that they don't short-circuit the systems in trying to solve problems as they emerged. And at this point, Juan is doing amazing things, like things that we never even thought of, like tuning the room scheduling system with the HVAC system. So if there's a meeting room that's not being used, it shuts down, and it sees, oh, a meeting's coming in at 2, we're going to start the cooling 15 minutes before the meeting, and it'll be cool by the time the meeting starts. So the building's getting more and more efficient as he fine-tunes it. So let me jump now to the results, right? So the first year, this is the, without getting into too much detail on this, this was our energy model, or this was the baseline or the benchmark building. Anything above the zero line is energy use, anything below is energy production. And this is what a typical building would have done on our site. Our prediction was that we were going to use about 18, what's called kBTUs, it's just a unit of energy, and produce a little more than that just as a safety factor. The measured result is that we used, in the first year, slightly more than what we predicted and produce slightly more, which still yielded a net positive building, really, even more than net zero. In this, in the year that's followed, we're actually using even less energy and getting back closer to the model. So this is the monthly energy use of what a typical building would use. You see there's a lot of heating here in red in the winter, a lot of cooling in the summer. Our predicted model brought that way down, so there was still some heating and still some cooling. But in reality, the cooling has gone almost to nothing. There's really almost no cooling that the building needs because of how good that envelope is, how little the lights are on, and so forth. The heating in the first year was a little more than we expected, partly through some equipment failures that had to be replaced, which is fairly surprisingly typical in buildings where things kind of fail during the first year. You have to replace them. And it was a cold winter, as Craig had mentioned. So we were learning through this monitoring. Most buildings don't have this kind of actual data. I'm sure the people in the building profession in this audience will attest to that, that it's kind of the holy grail to get this kind of data, and we never actually get it. So that's a big accomplishment in itself. And then to pull back and give us context, this is a study by the New Buildings Institute of all the zero energy or ultra low energy buildings that they could find, office buildings. Our project is here at number 12. This year we'll probably be down here. But you can see they're all in this band of energy use around what's called 20 kBTU. And a typical building, measured building out there, is about 90. So you can see we're talking about dropping energy use by, you know, basically 25% of a typical building that's out there in order to make it feasible to get it to zero energy. The good news is you can actually do that. I think hopefully my presentation has made that clear. It's not rocket science. It's actually achievable, and just with some kind of step-by-step kind of clear thinking and a great client. My last slide is the other side of the first year results, the qualitative side. And we administered a survey through the Center for the Built Environment at Berkeley. And we do this for a lot of our projects. Each of these little diamond shapes is a building in their survey for occupant satisfaction. And you can see Packard was at 97th percentile of all those projects they surveyed, just for they asked people, how happy are you? You know, how comfortable, how satisfied are you with the building? These other projects are other EHDD projects that are either zero energy or ultra low energy. And what we're seeing is that there's a really strong correlation between low energy projects and buildings that people like to be in. And we think it's because people like being in narrow buildings with lots of daylight, views, fresh air. They don't like a lot of cold air blowing on them and hot air. They like the buildings that are designed to be low energy. So I think it's really a brighter future rather than some kind of scary sacrificial future that we're facing. And with that, we won't actually do questions now, but thank you. I'm going to actually turn it over to Mike for the last. Oh, please.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, the David and Lucille Packard Foundation Net Zero Energy LEED Platinum Headquarters Building, with Craig Naaman, who is Vice President and Chief Financial Officer at the Packard Foundation, Brad Jacobson, whom you've just heard from, who is with EDHH, and Mike Mezick is going to talk to us now. He is from the DPR construction firm. I just wanted to make a quick announcement to you. We actually had a program on the Exploratorium here at the Commonwealth Club under the Environmental and Natural Resources Forum. It was a great program, and my grandchildren would tell all of you, if you haven't gone yet, you have to go. So, Brad, we really enjoyed the building. And now we're going to enjoy a wonderful talk on this building, which is just spectacular. We are still online.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. So just to reintroduce myself again, I'm Mike Mezick. I'm a project manager at DPR Construction. I was the project manager with DPR on the Packard Foundation, working closely with Craig and Brad on that project. And as Ann has mentioned, an amazing, amazing building, an amazing team. And if you hadn't seen it yet, definitely try and get down there and take a look. So bear with me. I'm not a presenter. I'm a builder. It's my first time presenting on this, so I... Hope you get something out of this. I've been asked to come here to talk and give the general contractor's perspective in building net zero energy buildings. So, just kind of some of the background credentials. Okay. So, some of the background credentials on DPR. We have now completed 3 net zero energy LEED Platinum buildings. Obviously, the Packard Foundation, which we just mentioned, but we've also done our DPR Phoenix Regional Office as a net zero energy building. In fact, was the largest net zero energy building in the world, certified net zero energy building in the world before Packard Foundation knocked it off the ledge. Our San Diego office, it was our first net zero energy building, and it is certified as well, LEED Platinum. And I'm actually currently managing the design and construction of our San Francisco office, which is due to open at the end of April, which is also targeting a net zero certification. So as you can imagine, with four net zero energy buildings under our, three under our belt and one nearly under our belt, we've gained quite a bit of experiences and lessons learned through the process. Personally, I know I have, and our other offices have done a really amazing job of capturing those things and trying to pass them along to me and other parties who want to build net zero, because we're like the Packard Foundation. We're trying to promote this. We want this to to be the new norm, not the cutting edge. So, in saying that, I in doing the research for this presentation, I took all the notes, and believe me, there's a lot of lessons learned out there, and so I tried to pluck a few out that I thought were relevant, and kind of crossed amongst the different projects we've done. I was originally going to focus on just the construction aspects, but as a company, we've obviously been involved right from the get-go on these projects, design, into construction, and now we're living in these buildings. So some of my lessons learned will cross those, but hopefully it'll kind of give you an idea of some of the things to look out for if you're planning to do a similar building. Excuse me. Okay. Which one is it?
Press forward on the laptop.
Oh.
On the keyboard. Press.
Mm-hmm. Sorry. Okay. Well, it's okay.
Oh, there it is.
There you go. Sorry about that. So this is just the first slide here is really just to show you the four buildings we've done. Packer Foundation's in there in the bottom left. The top left is our San Diego office. Top right is our Phoenix office. And the bottom right is going to be our new San Francisco office located on Front Street. All three of our buildings were built within existing buildings. So we were, as opposed to the Packer Foundation, which was out of the ground construction. So pretty non-technical slides here as opposed to Brad's, but really want to just run through fairly quickly kind of the lessons learned that we had. So the first one that seemed to be a common theme was when you sit down to do this project is to bring in the major stakeholders, you know, whether it's two, three, four, five, however you decide, and set clear project goals. You want to prioritize those goals and really memorialize them so that everyone keeps the same goals as you go through the project. So since we're talking about net zero energy, DPR San Francisco office, that was our overriding goal. It was to find a building and then to build a net zero energy building in an urban environment and show that it can be done. So be prepared when you set those goals, especially with net zero energy as the top goal, that's going to drive some challenging decisions as you go through the process. So, you know, it definitely will test some of the architectural elements you want to put in. It'll test some of your workstation layouts and some of your conference room layouts. But I think if you keep your eye on the prize, it really will work out in the end, and you'll be extremely happy, and so will the employees. Two, and this is a lesson I'm learning right now, but it's really to engage your local utility provider early in the process. With a net zero energy building, it is quite likely that you're going to either have to upgrade your service or put in a new service. And this could be a pretty lengthy process. So with some pretty rigid or inflexible construction schedules with your utility company. So you want to iron those out early. You want to understand the process. You want to kind of lock in the construction dates. And then you really want to work towards those because missing those dates can lead to some pretty significant delays. The other reason for getting in early, and particularly PG&E and some of the other utilities across the state of California, is the Savings by Design program that they offer. So it's an incentive program to designers, builders, and owners of net zero energy buildings. The caveat being that PG&E has a team that wants to get in and review your drawings during the design, conceptual, schematic, and have, you know, some say in how the building's designed from an energy standpoint. So it's definitely something you want to engage. If you miss the boat on that and it goes in for permit, you generally they won't make you eligible for those incentives. And then last under this topic really is just understanding your local utility rates. This can and may drive the layout, the number of PV panels, the orientation, so that you're so really providing, you know, you're maximizing the energy efficiency and not overspending, just putting panels everywhere you need to put them. You know, so you really, you know, if you understand those utility rates, it'll help you with that design. Okay. No? Do you need me to go on? Okay. All right. I'll speed it up. Let me find it again. So just, you know, I'll skip a few. So measurement and verification. I just wanted to really point this one out. You know, you've done all the hard work. You've designed the building. You've built the building. You've now moved into the building. You want to be able to show, you know, yourselves, you know, and in the outside world, I guess, that you are, you know, what you're achieving and how you're achieving it. So part of this is implementing some fairly complex controls that goes into the building, which you don't want to underestimate. There is a lot of time involved, a lot of planning, and it is pretty technical. So you want to make sure you have the right design team on board that can support that. You want to have a very tight sequence of operations for the building. Unlike your standard office building, these buildings, the systems all operate really as one. So you need someone who understands writing a sequence of operation. You know, how does the lighting work with the shades? How does the HVAC work with the windows? Do the windows open automatically? You know, so there's a lot that goes into it, and it's very technical, and you need the right people on board to support that. The other thing we found, and I know Packer Foundation has this as well, it's implementing a building dashboard. So this can be a visible, say, TV screen you have in your front lobby. It can also be something that's networkable, so your employees can dial in. How old's that? Get into the network and see how the building is actually performing. So they feel a vested interest in how they are contributing to the net zero energy process. And it also allows the building and your people living in the building to adjust against the energy model. So you can watch your performance against the energy model. Say, hey, we're having some problems here. Where are the problems? You know, maybe our plug loads are higher than we expected. We need to retrain. So it allows you to kind of change the course a little bit. And I know our San Diego office had that exact issue. So their plug loads were, they said almost double we're coming on double almost what the energy model was saying. So they quickly had to adjust and figure out how to resolve that. So, okay, let's see. So I'll just show, I know I only got a minute or two here. So ghost loads. So this is something we've found in that. So what a ghost load is many of your appliances, your LCDs, your power supplies are drawing power 24/7, 365 days a year, whether you're using it or not. So, you know, when you're home over the weekend or at night, these appliances and printers and monitors are constantly drawing power. So, which on the scheme of things wouldn't seem like a lot, but over the course of a year, these can add up to thousands of kilowatts, thousands of watts of power that you're basically wasting. So our San Diego and our Phoenix office and in our San Francisco office, we're putting in what's called, they're calling it a ghost switch or kill switch. So it's really a single point for a switch that basically the last person out of the building hits the switch. It kills certain non-critical loads, and you're saving, we're figuring right now we're going to save 10 to 20% on our plug loads just by using that the kill switch. Last but not least, commissioning. You know, just make sure you allow ample time in your schedule for commissioning the building. Again, these buildings are, I guess you can call them living buildings. So they're working as one. And, the Packer Foundation, I know it took a little while for the building to fine tune itself, and as for our other offices, and so it takes a little bit of time to work through the systems, make sure the sequence of operations is working, make sure all the equipment is working correctly. But make sure you allow ample time in your schedule for that. We would also highly recommend bringing in a third-party commissioning agent to lead you through that process. So that's it. Thank you.
This is Ann Clark, and you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio and our program, the Packard Foundation Net Zero Energy LEED Platinum Headquarters Building. And now for our audience questions. Questions from the audience?
Hi, I guess a question that was on many of our minds here is, what kind of cost does this add to the building, and both in time and in dollars? And if you could address that from you mentioned that you retrofitted some of those existing buildings as well as the ground up. What does that add, both in time, planning, and dollar costs?
Yeah, that's a great question. As a CFO, I'll field that one. The foundation is a grant maker, so we don't have full-time people who know how to build buildings. So we hired a owner's representative, Road Style, who actually managed this project for us. So we looked to them to answer that question for us. They estimated that there was a 20% increase for the sustainability features associated with the building. So as a hard-nosed CFO, I'm trying to look at that 20%. Some of that 20% is paid for by ROI for the investments we make, so solar panels. My estimate is our investment in solar panels and the labor and whatever of installation will be recovered over a 10-year period or less. So that ROI kind of makes a complete sense. There's some things for which there is not a clear ROI. The example I typically use is we deconstructed and recycled 95% of the building materials for the buildings that predated the existence of our building on that lot. Well, what's the ROI on that? Well, there's additional cost, but we didn't necessarily, you know, have, how can I explain that? We did it for moral ROI, I suppose. But 20% is the figure that we kicked around, and, you know, there's a lot I could say on that.
Just, I'll add one thing. You know, at the point we were starting the project, we set a goal of a replicability. The project would be replicable, and the way we defined that really was we were trying to set a path forward for the building industry 10 years out, right? So we knew we were early adopters. The idea wasn't that the project would necessarily be at the same cost today as any building you'd build, but we tried to show technologies and choose systems that we thought were poised to change the marketplace. So in some ways, I think trying to measure this project by the first cost today is probably not the right metric, and it's more about looking where the industry needs to go and is going to go so that these systems become the baseline.
I have two questions. The first one is for Brad. We're talking about the materials you used as the studding in the walls between those nice triple pane windows. If you use aluminum and some of the other metal studs that are used nowadays, I would imagine the heat conduct a lot more than wood. And what was the insulating material that you used between the studding and how, three questions, I guess, and how did you handle the cracks? I mean, if somebody's cutting a piece of Sellotex or some other material, sliding it in, if there's a quarter inch crack, that's a lot of heat loss.
That's true. Well, I'll let Mike handle the cracks since he was the one that was responsible for that. but it's a very good question. And actually, when we first started the project, we assumed metal stud walls, you know, and that's because that's what pretty much any office building is built with. But then we did modeling, we did computer simulations of what that actually would mean, and it was dramatic, the loss of heat through those metal studs. So we switched over to wood studs, which at this size building, we were pushing the limit where we could still do it. Any bigger office building, you couldn't, but it was a significant difference. The insulation material, we use conventional bad insulation, but then on the outside between covering the entire building, we use external insulation, and we're using something called mineral wool. It's a more kind of a natural material that has almost the same insulation value as the kind of the pink or blue board that you see that actually is quite, a chemical product that has a lot of impacts.
So as far as handling the cracks, so we, it was actually one of my points I didn't get to, but the quality control, you know, obviously on every building is important, but on a net zero energy building, it's paramount, especially with the exterior envelope, the roof. So, as we finished sections of the building, we had a quality control program in place to walk the building. You know, Packard, HDD, and the CM were all active participants, so it really helped. You know, we had a lot of eyes on it, so it was...
Okay, and my other question is directed to Craig. I don't know if you're familiar with the parking lots at Cal Expo, the ones that have the solar panels over the parking lots that rotate to follow the sun and also provide shade for the cars. I'm wondering if your foundation might put any money into these type of things. There are a hell of a lot of parking lots in this world in California that could be covered with those panels.
Well, it's a great idea. One of our largest grant-making areas is in climate issues, and so there's money being put into strategic efforts all over the place to try to do something about it. That's another good idea to add to the list.
Well, thank you all for a great presentation. We just finished making a film called The Future of Energy, and we covered some Z&E buildings, one commercial, one residential. I'm just wondering, from your opinion, what's the best way to inspire other building owners and residential homes to adopt this new method?
You know, I might take it just a hard-nosed CFO approach. So I think a lot of resistance might be economically driven. So I gave the 20% number, but let's not think about that for a sec. Let's think about the four major areas. One is energy production. just solar panels alone, with the ROI on solar panels, again, on our building is 10 years. I just put them on my house. My estimate is 7 years, cost recovery on solar panels. It just seems like the smart thing to do from just strictly a financial perspective. That's on the production side. Then you look at the three food groups of buildings, utilization of energy, plug loads, HVAC, and lighting. Well, on plug loads, we had really no net additional costs getting with Energy Star appliances as opposed to Energy Hog appliances. There's no net addition. So there wasn't an increased ROI. It was just smart choices. We have inkjets rather than laser jets. Inkjets use a little bit more ink but are significantly less energy. So just making those smart choices, no additional costs associated with that. Lighting. There's probably a 1 to 2 year additional payback for additional costs of lighting fixtures. That's not too hard to get around. HVAC is probably the most complex, and there is additional amount associated with that. But if you figure with solar panels, the ROI on that is kind of, I think you can earn back your dollars if you just kind of extend back the benefits from the solar, layer that into your HVAC. So I would say if you look at it from a hard-nosed CFO perspective, and sharpen your pencil, you might actually inspire more people to kind of do the things that we did.
I have a question about potential obstacles for scaling up these innovations. First, are there problems with building codes around the country? Secondly, problems with architectural or building software? And third, the problem of retraining the commercial and residential construction companies that would have to do the work.
I'll address the first two. I think, California's new energy code that's going to be coming out probably in July takes a big step forward. So I think as the, and other states are definitely behind, but as that kind of baseline moves up, if the code is here now, it's moving up here and zero energy's here, that delta getting smaller will really help. So I think the codes, improving codes is a big driver and really helps. I think we're learning a lot through these kind of projects about the limitations of energy modeling is a very important part of this, being able to predict how much energy buildings are going to use so you can design it better and size things better. And they're not really tuned up to predict real energy. They're tuned up to kind of allow code compliance. So that's fairly technical discussion, but it is something that we are able to gain out of this kind of project where we're actually seeing the model was saying this, but we're actually using this much. And it's been it's productive for the industry. And building trades, how are we going to retrain everyone?
Yeah, it's a step-by-step process. Being a company that has offices across the country, we're able to train our own people and our own, in other states. And, obviously we live in California. It's kind of the energy bubble, and the subs here pick up on things like that fairly quickly, just like LEED took off, back in the day. I remember doing my first LEED project, and it was like, wow, nobody knows, anything about what's in their materials, what's being recycled, and now it comes out as part of their submittal. So, it's a step-by-step process. So,
unfortunately, we reached the point in our program for our last question and final comments, and I always get to ask the last question. And this is for each of the panelists. What was the toughest decision that you made in this project? And you may have more than one, but what was the toughest? What were you wrestling with the most? And we'll start with Craig Naiman, Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, the Packard Foundation.
Gee, I don't know about toughest. How about I answer with a lesson learned? I think I took a tour of the Hoover Dam at one point as a kid, and I remember them saying the Hoover Dam was built with 2 to 3 times as much concrete as they needed because they never done such a project before. Well, in our office, we have, I understand, 15 to 20,000 separate inputs that we monitor. We monitor every single light, so we know the voltage of every light. For those on the radio, I have a full head of hair with lots of locks down my shoulders. If I were actually to use a air dryer in my office one day and suck a lot of voltage, Juan, our building engineer, would know about that. I don't think that level of monitoring actually is necessary. So we kind of, I think, significantly overbuilt the extent of the monitoring we had because If you look at the total plug loads for the building, 30% of a building's energy use being plug loads, half of that is in one room, our server room. The other half is 15% shared across 120 people across the whole building. There's really not that much differential in the behaviors of those individuals. It's actually in the smart guys like Brad, who knows how to build a building smart. So I'd say maybe an overbuilt managing system.
Mike Mesnick?
So again, I decision-wise, I can't think of a, you know, I'm sure there's lots of tough decisions, but from a, I'll just point to kind of a frustrating part, and I mentioned controls. I mean, we had controls on controls in the building, and it really, you're dealing with something that's so complex that there's only a couple people on the project that fully understand it. So just managing that process and getting that through to the end date was, to me, one thing I'll always take with me, so it's frustrating.
Brad Jacobson?
Architects have to make a lot of decisions throughout the process, so I can definitely answer this. And the first thing I thought of was some of the early decisions that we made that actually were counter to what a strict kind of sustainability-driven, you know, engineering-driven approach might be. One was the building orientation. So if you saw, remember the site plan, the building is oriented. In other words, it's aligned along the sidewalk. In fact, that's at a kind of a 45-degree angle to the solar path. So for anyone who's, you know, knows basics of kind of passive solar design, you want your building facing south and north with narrow west and east. Well, we looked at that, and it was going to look like a spaceship landed in Los Altos, and that went counter to one of the major goals of the client, which was to really fit in, create a beautiful building that fit into the community. So we took a little energy hit on that, but we worked with our team on it, and we knew it was going to be, you know, we could manage it. The other was the shape of the roofs. We have a symmetrical building. The roofs face in different directions. And so one roof is facing in a kind of funny direction for solar gain for the PVs. And we knew we'd take a lot of hits from the solar industry. And we people come up to me a lot after talks and, what were you thinking? You know, well, it's a big picture, right? And we're trying to make a beautiful building that shows that this is not some one-off thing, some weird, building for people who are so dedicated. It's actually a beautiful building. So I think those are the kind of decisions that are tough, but I think in the big picture were the right ones to make.
Thank you so much, and thank you to our audience and our audience on the radio and on the internet for joining us for our program, the Packard Foundation Net Zero LEED Platinum Headquarters Building. A special thanks to our panel tonight. We had a wonderful panel and wonderful information that I think we're all going to carry with us as we go leave the room and look forward to the future. We want to thank Craig Naiman, who is the Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of the Packard Foundation, Brad Jacobson, who's Senior Associate of EHDD, and Mike Mezick, who is the Project Manager at DPR Construction. We hope you will all join us for our upcoming 2014 New Visions program. April 1st will be critical mass, joining together to save our planet. April 23rd, Latino heritage, culture, and the environment. And we will be joining you, too, on April 30th, the Endangered World Rivers and Deltas. Our thanks to Kevin O'Malley, Chair of the Business and Leadership Member-Led Forum, for co-sponsoring this important program. And again, our thanks to you, our wonderful audience, our wonderful panel, and the Packard Foundation for this very interesting and, I think, exciting program to hear what is going to hold for the future that we will see coming fairly soon from everything that you've demonstrated and talked about tonight. Again, my thanks. And I am Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Program. And this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 111 years, and I remind my adult children that I am not 111 years old, but the Commonwealth Club is, and it has been an enlightened discussion for all those years, in the know, is adjourned.